welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing the conversations about the cultures of consciousness. It was over 15 years ago, I believe, and I was at an event here in San Francisco, and somebody told me that that guy over there was writing a book about, putting together a book about Buddhism and psychedelics. And at that time, I was deeply immersed in my own Dharma practice, and I was, as I continue to be, fascinated by the questions of psychedelics, the relationship of molecules to mysticism. And so I tracked down this guy as soon as I could, and I tried to impress him. And after some reticence, he became interested in my ideas, and so I was able to contribute the book to the book that this fellow had produced, the fellow being Alan Bediner, and the book being Zigzag Zen, Buddhism and Psychedelics, a book he edited with Alex Gray back in the day. It came out in 2002, and I just pulled out my copy because I wanted to compare it to the new edition of the book, which has just come out earlier this year. And to find out there's a number of exciting new articles in it, and I was kind of comparing them, and then I turned to the title page, and I'd forgotten that we had done – well, I remember the event, but I'd forgotten that at this event we did at Spirit Rock, there were a lot of high and holy characters there. So I have this wonderful title page with signatures from Jack Kornfeld and Stan Groff and Houston Smith and Ram Dass, which is all pretty nifty. That was a very very fun day, and it was fun not just because it was an interesting cast of characters, but because the topic really goes to some of the core issues about the role of psychedelics in modern Western society, the role of Buddhism in modern Western society, how these things overlap, how they resist each other. And, of course, both of these worlds of practice and worlds of discourse have changed quite drastically since 2002. And I'm happy to say that I would say the book is even more timely now than it was. In some sense, it was one of those books that was a little bit before its time, even though it got some very good attention. These were still pretty marginal discourses in the turn of the 2000s. Even Buddhism has become much more installed in public imagination, as well as psychedelics, of course, with the psychedelic renaissance that we're talking about. So it's really it's nice when a book that has some classic old school roots, it becomes magically timely again. And so I'm really happy to have Alan on the show, so we can talk about that, and then some of the other projects and interests that he has. I've been friends with Alan since that time, and he's always good for a scintillating laugh. All right, Alan, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
My pleasure, Eric. Thank you.
That's great, and you're calling from the.
I'm just enjoying a little scintillating laugh myself.
You're calling from the wilds of Big Sur.
Yes, I am. I guess it seems very peaceful to me, but I guess that's an apt title for life in Big Sur, which can turn from peaceful to harsh storms at a moment's notice.
Yeah, you know, I've visited your place a number of times, and it's right, it's quite near Esalen, which I've also spent some time at, but I've actually never been there when there was a ferocious storm. I would really like to see that, because, well, then I think the wilds would really be more apparent.
Yes, for sure. Well, I hope you do, and I hope you're safe and in a good place when you witness it.
One question, have you seen a lot of whales this year?
Oh, absolutely. The whales are putting on a show that seems endless. It's just really exciting. Of course, a lot of times I'm busy paying attention to other things, and friends and guests or whatever will say, "Oh, my God, look at that." And I, for a moment, forgot what they're all excited about, and then I see that they're noticing the traffic of the whales. Unfortunately, the otters aren't doing as well. The otters that were known for this coast have diminished in number quite seriously, and now they've been added to the extinction list.
Yes, I've been tracking that. It's very sad. I think part of the problem is there's this enormous algae bloom off the coast of the West Coast, and it produces some toxin that's particularly unfavorable for the little fellows. But I know there's other issues as well.
Like the percentage of oil content in the water just climbs gradually every year.
Yeah, no, it's a tough one, but at least the whales are holding on.
The whales are strolling through, yes.
You know, we just visited Alaska, and there were saw a lot of humpback whales, and apparently they're just about to be taken off the endangered species list. So the humpbacks were high and mighty, and it was marvelous to see them in you know, dozens and dozens merrily feeding, and just to know that how close they came to extinction, and that these kinds of efforts can really make a difference in certain circumstances. So gives us hope that other things, including the sea otter, can rejoin the thriving, you know, the few species that are thriving now, and I hope that happens. Listen, congratulations on the new edition of Zigzag Zen. I'm really glad that you were able to put that together. You know, oftentimes people do projects, you know, 10, 15 years ago, and they're like, you know, whatever, I got to move on, got to do something different. But again, I think it's really timely, and I'm happy to see some of the new articles in it. Talk a little bit about like in a way, because you got to put together a new volume, there's new images. You know, the book, the original had a lot of beautiful images curated by Alex, and the new one has more images. So putting together the images and the new stories, it gave you an opportunity to think about how things have changed in, you know, almost 15 years since the book came out. So I'd love to hear a little bit about that process and what you discovered in it.
Sure. Well, I think it's true what you say about the book being even more relevant now than it was some 14 years ago when the book original edition came out. There's still, you know, I think quite a bit of relevance for the material that came out in the original edition, but there was also a great deal of possibility for bringing new conversations and subtopics into the book, which I'm really glad has come together really quite beautifully. And Alex Gray, who was my partner in terms of editing the art, while I edited the essays, he was in charge of the art, and he did an incredible job again of attracting really some of the most exciting artists to contribute their pieces for the book. I mean, you know, originally there was a lot of new artists and well-known artists in a sort of mix, and the same is true of those new artists that came to the book with their work this time. And it's quite a variety, you know. So I'm really excited about that, and invite everyone to take a look at that. And the essays that are new, there are approximately six chapters that are new. I'll just go through and mention, identify them. Ralph Metzner wrote an original essay for the book entitled A New Look at the Psychedelic Tibetan Buddha's Book of the Dead. So he's taking a new look at the relevance of what that book means to us in our modern lives. I also interviewed Rick Doblin, who is the founder of Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, MAPS, and who has personally made it his life's work to bring psychedelic materials into consideration for medical use and facilitating the protocols for studying this, and has been very successful. I mean, I remember when some 20 years ago when Rick Doblin was first determined to set out on this journey, and I said, Rick, come on. I forget who was president at the time. I think it was somebody like Reagan or something, and I said, well, you know, you're dreaming, you know, you're hallucinating. Just, you get a real job. And his efforts are a testament to the power of persistence and keeping a clear vision, which he has done. And he's now, and MAPS is involved in a series of studies, some in partnership with the federal government. The Veterans Administration is very interested in the use of psilocybin and MDMA for PTSD, because it's the only interventions that have had any efficacy at all, lasting efficacy. So that's really exciting. And I interviewed him about the new work that MAPS is involved with. And I think that in a sense it's very relevant, because in Buddhism, Buddhism exists really for the extinguishment of suffering. And Rick's work is all about that. Also, I thought it would be interesting to bring another voice of criticism to the book. The book, as a lot of people may not realize initially, is also, it includes a spectrum of thinking on the issue of psychedelics and Buddhism. So it's not all about, you know, the wonders and the fantastic contributions psychedelics are making. It's also about criticisms about whether Buddhism and or the Dharma and drugs mix or don't mix. And so I was taken to task quite intensively by a young teacher and writer, Brad Warner, in a book that he did. So I thought I'd like to invite him to speak within the book, the next edition, and he graciously accepted. So he contributed a very interesting essay called Waking Yourself, which takes issue with the use of psychedelics when you're having a when you are trying to pursue a Dharma practice. Another very interesting essay is from David Coyote, who's been a long-time student of Zen and is currently on a year-long retreat with his teacher. But prior to that, he's had a lot of experience with ayahuasca in Zen settings, doing retreats both here and in South America, and leading Zen meditation programs within the context of the ayahuasca retreats. And so he wrote about that in a very interesting essay called Waking Up Together, The Interweaving of Buddhism and Ayahuasca. Jana Draka is a ordained Buddhist nun who works in San Francisco and in Santa Cruz and in other areas around mid-California. And she tends to the homeless. She's one of the few ordained Zen priests who actually make it their focus to support that community of people. And she wrote an essay called Buddhist Harm Reduction and Cannabis. And she talks about her work with cannabis and about treating people with alcoholism and other issues with both compassion and plant medicine. And then finally, a very interesting dialogue took place in Santa Cruz, which I was able to, with the gracious permission of the two principal speakers, get a hold of and put together a presentation based on that dialogue. And that's with James Fadiman, who's a longtime psychedelic scholar and writer and teacher, and Kokyo Henkel, who is the chief monk at Santa Cruz Zen Center, ordained monk and I think head of that center. And they had a dialogue about called Buddhism and Psychedelics, a public dialogue, and raising all the current issues and inviting the people that were there to also ask questions. So I think it was a rich collection of thinking and ideas and writers for the new edition. I'm very pleased about it.
It's great. I mean, and of course, a number of wonderful topics that you've already raised. So I would just sort of dive into one of these questions. I haven't gotten to the Brad Warner piece, but I am very interested in this, in some of the questions that are raised. In fact, for me, one of the interesting things about the whole project is an opportunity to give people a space to critique psychedelics from a spiritual practitioner point of view, but not in the old school, like, oh, these are, it's just delusion, or it's just you know, getting off, and it's not, you know, the ascetic's pursuit of the spirit or whatever, but really people who are sympathetic and have even perhaps gone through these experiences, but then offer often more nuanced criticisms that you don't necessarily find within the psychedelic community and that you don't usually find in other spiritual communities, because it's just sort of the unspoken assumption that nobody's taking drugs or taking drugs particularly for spiritual reasons. So without necessarily rehearsing Brad's argument, I'm curious for you, as someone who's interested in these debates and has gotten into discussions with other people who have different views, how your views maybe have changed, or how you've come to think about this issue of the appropriateness of psychedelics within the context of a broader spiritual commitment to Buddhist practice.
Right. Well, that's an interesting question. Actually, I think of this book as a conversation, and as I mentioned, it includes voices that criticize the idea that you can have a Dharma practice and be engaged in the use of psychedelics, and both from a practical perspective and also from a philosophical perspective. And, of course, there are quite a few essays that take issue with that position as well, and I think it's extremely interesting and topical to look at those questions and have that conversation. In terms of my own views, I'm actually more conservative about psychedelic use than some of the people who took issue with it in the book, like Brad, for instance. I mean, he's a graduate of quite a few more adventures than I am, and I think one of his last adventures, his use of psychedelics, ended up with the proverbial bad trip, and so he became negatively inclined on all fronts regarding psychedelics. But he said he still enjoys psychedelic culture and psychedelic art, and he just doesn't want to be in a position where his mind gets taken over by external molecules and sort of taken away from his control. And so I understand that position, and that's been part of why I've been quite conservative about use. I used to go around talking about Zig Zag Zen years earlier, saying, you know, asking my audience, who in this room has not taken LSD? And my hand went up, and maybe a few hands went up, and I always professed pleasure at knowing that I wasn't the only one. I can no longer put my hand up to that question, but that's only one instance of use. So I would say that I totally understand the position that there is no place for psychedelics in a Buddhist practice. I understand, and in some respects, I agree with elements of it. I mean, I think one has to be very careful and thoughtful and conscious about how you integrate them. But I think it's an important conversation to have, as I've seen tremendous personal benefit from realized by other people, and in the conversation itself, I think we learn a great deal about ourselves and Buddhism and how we hold it, and our views on psychedelics, I think, are very revealing also. So I think it's also a process of self-discovery just to be involved in the conversation.
Absolutely. No, I mean, that's to me one of the reasons when I first heard the project, I was so excited, was not just because I was interested in the topics, but because I'm totally committed to this idea of bringing things that have overlap but lots of tensions between them. You bring them together and you get involved in that dialogue, and it forces you, just as that process itself forces a kind of opening, a kind of broadening for multiple perspectives, and then for still having to make decisions. You know, it's not just like, oh, well, there's different perspectives. It's like, okay, great, but what's your decision? What are you going to do? How are you going to move forward in this question? And it's interesting one about thinking about psychedelics and when and why people decide to kind of step away, or they've had enough for now, or they've had enough forever. And there are a wide variety of reasons for that. And sometimes they're, you know, terrible experiences. Sometimes they're reflections about how much good it's actually doing? Am I just returning again and again? I mean, I think some criticisms I've heard of people who are enthusiastic ayahuasqueros, which is sort of the most significant psychedelic religiosity that we see to these days, where people are clearly very devoted and they're very spiritual. They use spiritual language to describe what they're doing. It's about transformation, healing the earth, whatever. But then I've also talked to people who have come out on the other end and been like, well. And then I realized after a while I was just kept returning, it was all about just going back and doing another ceremony and doing another ceremony. And it was like, well, what am I doing? I'm just going and doing these marvelous ceremonies. It's not really clear what's really going on, behind this. And I've also spoken to some, very heavy psychonauts, like far more hardcore than most of the folks I know, and including myself, although I guess I know a lot of, pretty heavy psychonauts. But some of these guys will be like, even with that, they'll be like, wow, I'm giving my mind over to these entities. I don't know what these guys are. I don't know what they want from me. So it's funny how you get these reactions that are really similar, even from very different perspectives. But the one thing I wanted to say about Brad, even though I haven't read the article, but what you said about Brad's response about a negative experience is that for me, a lot of the most valuable spiritual material that I have come out of psychedelic experience with, I have to do with the negative sides of it. It has to do with my fears, with things I've been shown about the world and about human desire and the nature of technology, and things that are very disturbing sometimes. So, the sort of more on the Groff's the way the Groff has been talking about H.R. Giger and sort of putting a place, there's a place for that world inside of the larger zone of a psychedelic experience. And so I'm almost more willing to distrust the beatific, I was one with the cosmos and everything was vibrating and everything was love. It's like, great, that's a wonderful place to be. I love it. But then, what do you just know that that's accessible? Where I've often learned things, from those experiences, but also from ones that are on the dark side. And I think that's in Buddhism too. I mean, I think that one of the things that's marvelous about Buddhism, in a very different register, but nonetheless, is that it's really giving you the tools or the encouragement, the sort of invitation to sit with very difficult things, very, very difficult things. And so exactly. I think that there's an overlap, not just with the positive stuff, but also with the confrontation with suffering, with death, with the paranoia that structures the ego, that some of the dark side stuff is also very illuminated by this connection.
Well, Eric, I agree with you 100%, and I'm glad you raised that frame to look at the book through. By the way, before I forget, I just want to again thank you for your tremendous contribution to the book. Your essay, The Paisley Gate, is amazing in terms of how it gives the reader a sense of how Buddhism integrated into the culture early on. It's really interesting. People would ask me, well, why Buddhism and psychedelics? I mean, that just doesn't seem to be a way to pick two different, totally different topics and try to force them together. But it really isn't a forcing together of those topics. They came almost together to the culture. I mean, if we look at some of the people that were talking about Zen and Buddhism early on in American culture, Alan Watts, Ram Dass, Jack Kerouac, Allen Ginsberg, and others, they were all talking about Buddhism and psychedelics at the same time. So the introduction of one came very much in close connection to the other. So that was that's an interesting part of the history, which is not often recognized.
It's funny, and along with that, so on the one hand, both of these things overlap and are inextricable from the counterculture that is now, expanded and become part and, transformed, but become part of a lot of the culture, the mainstream culture, the things we refer to, mindfulness techniques and the visual images that everybody sees that you can trace to psychedelia and other, so many things that come out of the counterculture. But another interesting connection is that as both Buddhism and psychedelics have made their way into the mainstream, that one of the main ways or one of the main paths that they've both taken is through science, and particularly neuroscience, that
right.
both have featured this tremendous amount of studies. You know, like if you compare Buddhism to any other religion, it's not even close. It's just, you know, maybe some Hindu practitioners, some yoga stuff, especially in the earlier period in the 70s and 80s, got a lot of scientific research. But by and large, the neuroscientific psychological studies on spirituality and mysticism have focused on Buddhist practitioners. And that, to me, is also very interesting, that there's something about the brain and about the nervous system that both of these practices and discourses point to, that again has a very interesting kind of resonance.
Right, exactly, and they are being studied together as part of a serious scientific look at the brain and you know, hoping that insights on the brain actually become more clear. There's a study with experienced psilocybin users, psilocybin users and experienced meditators that is ongoing right now in Switzerland. And there's another study out of Johns Hopkins here in the United States that is being conducted by a very prestigious scientist who's looking at Roland Griffiths, who's looking at the brain and how it functions when both modalities are at play, whether a person is an experienced meditator or experienced psychonaut or both. And, you know, there's a lot of excitement about what this will tell us. And, I mean, both of these, you know, modalities are where they make their real impact is in the brain and in our consciousness. And so it's a very rich area of study for sure. Anyway,
yeah.
It's early to draw conclusions about that, but I think that that's a super rich area of study and very interesting to see what happens with some of these inquiries.
Well, here's another kind of angle on the question now, especially thinking about how things have changed over the last 15 years. What role, in terms of the kind of health, vitality, dynamism, kind of an engagement of American Buddhism? So just talking about American Buddhism now and the ways that it's changing, you know, the mindfulness has become much more mainstream, so much so that some people within the Buddhist community are increasingly critical of some mindfulness practices because
right.
they feel that they've extracted a sort of technology from a much larger matrix of ethics and spirituality,
exactly.
and they've kind of plugged it into some, you know, the capitalist machine. And so they're like, that's not what we were trying to do by bringing Buddhism into the West. So Buddhism itself is going, you know, undergoing an ongoing conversation about its nature, its relevance, what it provides for modern people in the West, in America. What role does psychedelics play in that? Do you think there's something about the...
I think a very important role. I'm glad you mentioned it. I mean, you know, from the perspective of those of us who have the luxury to entertain these ideas, you know, driving a diesel Mercedes and writing checks to Greenpeace just isn't going to cut it anymore. We're in the context of what has been called the Anthropocene, where human activity is changing the ecosystem dramatically to the negative, and we have to look again at all of the potential tools that we have to change consciousness. Again, that's another very more relevant, more pressing aspect of this conversation, which I think, you know, makes this whole issue worth looking at very carefully. But, you know, in terms of what you were talking about of separating out mindfulness activity from the ethical system that Buddhism represents, when you bring Buddhism and psychedelics together, in a way, you're also bringing an ethical system to this experimentation of the mind, which I think really gives both actually a stronger position of making real change. I remember that having a little bit of a difference of opinion with a friend of mine who was engaged in setting up mindfulness practice within Monsanto Corporation. Monsanto liked the idea a lot because they saw evidence that practicing mindfulness increases the productivity of their employees. So they were all gung-ho, but it didn't bring in the Buddhist element, the ethical system, the ethics of Buddhism into it. It was really about, you know, the techniques of mindful meditation, etc. And she argued that can never be bad, and I took a different perspective. I mean, if you're going to take a company that's engaged in basically warfare with the natural systems of the planet for profit, and then make it more productive by adding mindfulness practice, I'm not sure you're making things better. You might be making things worse. One thing about the judicious and mindful use of psychedelics is that it takes you on a serious journey within yourself of awareness and the ability to get to know your thought process better, to get to know what you're holding about yourself and about life in an unconscious way, and it gives you a real tool to go deeper into that process, which is usually hidden from your conscious awareness. And then when you bring the Buddhist ethical system to that, I think it really enriches that process and makes it much more valuable and productive experience.
Yeah, it's so extremely well said. This reminds me of some other things, but we got to take a break right now. Sure. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis. We're talking with Alan Bediner, editor of the new edition of Zigzag Zen, Buddhism and Psychedelics, and we'll be right back.
This is Tony Hendra
and Jeff Chrysler
of the Final Edition Radio Hour
on PRN,
your source for organic,
gluten-free,
sustainable
satire.
I'm Glenn Ford.
And I'm Nellie Bailey.
Every Monday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, we bring you Black Agenda Radio here on the Progressive Radio Network. It's produced by the team at blackagendareport.com, the cutting-edge publication for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left.
So check out our view of the world and explore our rich archives on PRN.FM. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward.
And we hope you're coming with us.
This is PRN.FM. Tune in anytime for the latest in progressive news and ideas. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network, talking with Alan Bediner about Zigzag Zen, Buddhism, and psychedelics. You know, Alan, we were talking about how these two different systems overlap, and particularly what they have to tell us or encourage, invite us to experience in the context of global crisis, climate change, et cetera, et cetera. And one, I think, similarity, not necessarily true, not true in all circumstances, but one way in which they both resonate very deeply in terms of ways of seeing the world that can help our, you know, illuminate our current conundrum, is that they're both they both have the capacity to reveal the way in which the self, the individual, the human is deeply interconnected with the rest of the world, and that indeed a lot of the things that we might claim take ownership for as egos are themselves the products of larger systems that are swirling around us, that precede us, that are far more complicated than us, that will last far longer than we will, and that part of the ethics that comes up through Buddhism is precisely in relationship, you know, to that kind of experience, that kind of perception. I mean, I know you've studied with Thich Nhat Hanh, and I'll never forget the first time I encountered his description of how the piece, you know, you just hold a simple piece of paper, and then he starts talking about the piece of paper and where it comes from and the wood and the guy who cut down the wood and the water that rained in the place where the tree grew. And then suddenly that piece of paper is everything. And right. you can't live in that perception of totality, of total connection everywhere. Maybe it's psychosis, maybe it's absolute sainthood, but learning to become familiar and comfortable and open up to that, which can be very scary, seems to me something that both psychedelics and serious Buddhist practice encourage, a kind of willingness, the vulnerability of stepping out into a world where there are many other things going on that are very different than you, that have a lot to do with what's going on, and you're just, in some ways, just a part of the process. Is that resonate with you in terms of your own, you know, practice and your own approach to these issues?
Well, totally, and I think that is what you're really alluding to here is the deepest reason in my thinking why Buddhism is so relevant right now by itself and empowered by possibly, you know, other tools, including psychedelics, so that we can realize our deeply felt connection with all other life on the planet and the systems that make life possible. And when you have that sense of felt connection, then within you arises a sense of compassion and really feeling and caring about those systems and wanting to do what you can with your life to preserve them and preserve their integrity for generations to come. And I think that's the real crux of the issue. That's what really makes a difference with this inquiry. You know, I have a letter that was written by Albert Hoffman became aware of, and he wrote this letter a year before he died. I think he died, I'm not sure actually the date of his death, but perhaps you know, Eric, but when he was 102, he died, but he wrote this letter when he was 101. I think this was, within the decade. I'd like to read this. Would you mind if I did that?
No, it sounds wonderful.
It's not terribly long, but it's very powerful. So I'm quoting from Dr. Albert Hoffman, who was the discoverer or facilitator of LSD. So he writes, "Alienation from nature and the loss of experience of being part of the living creation is the greatest tragedy of our materialistic era. It's the causative reason for ecological devastation and climate change. Therefore, I attribute highest importance to consciousness change. I regard psychedelics as catalyzers for this. They're tools which are guiding our perception toward other deeper areas of our human existence so that we again become aware of our spiritual essence. Psychedelic experiences in a safe setting can help our consciousness open up to this sensation of connection and being one with nature. LSD and related substances are not drugs in the usual sense, but are part of the sacred substances which have been in use for thousands of years in ritual settings. The classic psychedelics like LSD, psilocybin, and mescaline are characterized by the fact that they are neither toxic nor addictive. It's my great concern to separate psychedelics from the ongoing debates about drugs and highlight the tremendous potential inherent to these substances for self-awareness as an adjunct in therapy and for fundamental research into the human mind. It is my wish that a modern Eleusis will emerge in which seeking humans can learn to have transcendent experiences with sacred substances in a safe setting. I'm convinced that these soul-opening, mind-revealing substances will find their way appropriately in our society and in our culture." That's a little long, but I thought it was very powerful and wanted to share it with you.
No, that certainly makes the point. I mean, it's a very strong argument, even as, of course, other things are happening as well. I mean, one of the interesting things today is to see how There are different ways that people are approaching questions of consciousness and questions of drugs and questions of exploring these dimensions. And I think that while the spiritual and nature-oriented framework for understanding and appreciating psychedelic experiences and mystical experiences in general, experiences of meditation, experiences of different kinds of consciousness techniques, etc., you know, that's very well established. It comes out of the counterculture. It has much deeper roots, and people are familiar with that. But at the same time, and especially in the last 15 years, we've seen this sort of rise of all these other ways of approaching it. You know, you have, you know, younger people today who are into consciousness hacking, and they're using machines to try to figure out how they can produce altered states with their brains. And, you know, they're buying novel research chemicals that are made in China from some formula synthesized 50, or, you know, developed 10 years ago, and exploring this whole kind of domain. And oftentimes it's somewhat loosened, let's say, from these more kind of ethical and spiritual considerations. And I don't think they're necessarily working in opposition. I think there's all sorts of interesting connections there. But it's really quite extraordinary when you look at the range of consciousness exploration that's going on today, and some of the very different motivations. So I think it's always important to realize that the meanings that we ascribe to these experiences, meanings like being more in touch with nature or recognizing how the ego is a source of suffering, that these are things that are not necessarily inside the experience so much as ways that we have developed to talk about, to situate, and to prepare ourselves to have these experiences. And so, the thing that we're doing, discussing, dialoguing, writing books, writing articles, even though in some sense it seems far away from the experience itself, actually helps to keep the culture going for the ways that these experiences can manifest themselves with real political, social, spiritual dimensions. And so I'm very cautiously interested, but also a little wary of some of the over-technologizing of consciousness techniques that we see now, including mindfulness, but also including some of the more extreme consciousness hacking technologies that are happening. They're very interesting, but it's really hard to say what the larger paradigm is in all that.
Yeah, I think you've really raised an important aspect of this, which is the experiences, to be able to pursue these experiences and to experiment and to engage in a serious inquiry using various tools to look at one's own consciousness is what's so critical, is the freedom to be able to do that. I mean, you could look at the drug war and on one sense say, well, this is a protection, a sort of built-in protection the society or the culture has to defend itself from too much rapid change, or whatever your theory is. But it really is about a war on consciousness. It's a war on the freedom to be able to make change within yourself and then ultimately in the culture. So I think that tradition of freedom is very, very important in Buddhism. It's enshrined as one of the most important principles. The Buddha gave a talk about this very topic in a sutra called the Kalama Sutra, where he talks about, don't take my word for it. Don't take the word of Buddhist monks or religious leaders. Follow what they're saying. Engage in experiments in your own life to see if it has any validity or efficacy in your own life. And then if it does, then practice it and follow it. And if it doesn't, let it go. But the being free to be able to make those choices for oneself is really what sort of drives, or has been driving, my interest in really looking deeply at this topic. So that while I may not want to jump in on the latest psychedelic or trip my, off to the through the Paisley Gate into the psychedelic realms, I want to know that that is available, that that's possible, that people are free to make those choices for themselves.
Well, it's a really important position to take as well, because if one is an advocate or even just sort of interested in supporting people's rights to to explore this way, it's very easy to be pigeonholed or whatever as being, oh, you're just into it. You're just, you know, you're just justifying your own pleasures or your own, you know, delusion, if you want to be harsh about it. So having the kind of position you occupy, where you're supportive and interested and sympathetic, but not necessarily a card carrying psychonaut, is a really important one. You know, we have about 10 minutes here, and I did want to ask you, since you've been exploring the Dharma for a very long time, and you've spent a lot of time in India, you've spent a lot of time with different teachers, different practices, you've moved in and out of different scenes. And when you think about the Buddha's, sort of admonition, don't take my word for it, don't take the monk's word for it, explore yourself, experience yourself, discover these things for yourself. In your years of practice and exploration, what are the things that have been the most illuminating for you? What were the, whether it was a relationship with a teacher or a particular practice or no practice at all, or, I would love to get a little bit of your more personal, that kind of outcomes that have arisen through your own experience.
Well, sure. I'm happy to speak on that. I mean, with the caveat that I don't have any compact, clever, easy to communicate conclusions about that whole process. That's been a long process of discovery for me, and it's still ongoing. One of the reasons that I became interested in psychedelics at all was, usually it's the other way around. Usually people take psychedelics and then they look for something more sustainable to work with their consciousness, like meditation. And for me, it was really kind of the opposite. I went to India for no other reason than I liked Indian food, and then I discovered a whole world, a whole culture there that was addressing, timeless questions. And I became kind of addicted to going to ashrams and learning from different teachers and sitting at the feet of different masters. And I had this idea that I would do a new edition of a book, very old book called In Search of Secret India by a journalist, and an English journalist, Paul Brunton. And I was going to do an update of that. That was sort of my thinking for a while. But when I would, after being a year in India, a friend of mine, and I was preparing to return to the States, a friend of mine said, you really need to get integrated with all this. You've got to pull yourself together so that you're not wandering around in America and, lost and confused. And it's going to be a shock to you when you go back. So what she recommended was that I go to a Buddhist meditation retreat in Sri Lanka and do a 2-week retreat and follow, the meditation course and see what happens then. And so I did that and chose a place called Rock Hill Hermitage, a very old monastery in the mountains of Sri Lanka near Kandy. And it was terrible. It was awful. I mean, my every bone in my body hurt with all this sitting, and there were bugs, and it wasn't particularly clean. And breakfast was at 6:30. It consisted of stewed greens, and the same stewed greens were served again for lunch at 11:30, and there was no dinner. And it was just like I couldn't bear it. And but I was determined to stick it through and stay with the plan. But I was getting more and more unhappy. My body was complaining big time. My neck, my bones, everything hurt. Then suddenly, it was 2 days before I was going to be finished, it all just dropped away. And I felt this tremendous, quiet sense of ecstasy. I mean, it was just, I was in a place that felt very familiar and yet incredibly thrilling, where I felt connected deeply to everything around me, including the bugs that I was before complaining about, and the trees and other people. I had a place in my heart that was reflecting all of that, and it was just a tremendously good feeling. So I left there with this, I don't know what to call it, meditative glow that was apparent for quite a while. It took a while for it to fade away, But what it instilled in me is a strong desire to learn more about this. What is it about Buddhism? What is it about that practice? What did I do? What brought that on? And it was actually looking for experience that, in a sense, compared were comparable or in some sense mimicked that feeling that led me to experiment with psychedelics. And find some similarity there. I remember the first time that I took MDMA and had that sense of closeness and compassion and connection along with this great good feeling that reminded me very much of my first powerful meditation experience in Sri Lanka. So I don't have answers. What it has done is committed me to the search, committed me to the process of discovery. And I'm still learning. I'm still putting together different ideas in my mind and playing with them, entertaining them, considering them. And so I don't have, a set of conclusions to share, but it has definitely emboldened my search and given me great energy to pursue it.
Well, one of the projects that have come out of that that we've talked about a lot, and I know it's sort of like, and you mentioned it, or at least a version of it, is this idea of the kind of pilgrimage experience in India, and something that I did. My wife and I on our honeymoon went to the 8 sites associated with the Buddha's life, and it was a marvelous experience. It was one of the most fun. I mean, I love spiritual tourism because even when you're acting just like a tourist, there's everyone there is, you know, they're acting like tourists, except they're there for a real reason. So the blend between pilgrimage and tourism is just, you know, delicious and quite profound and quite fascinating. And I know that this has been a project you've been thinking about or working around in various different ways for a long time. And I'd just like to just hear a little bit about whether either that's going forward or even if it's not, some of your interests and feelings and responses to the whole process of being particularly on the Buddha trail in India.
Yeah, that's definitely. Thanks, Eric, for bringing that up. I'm determined to do to create a book about that. I call it Buddha Land, all one word, Pilgrimage to India, and it was such a powerful experience in subsequent trips to India to go to the 8 great places as you mentioned, and you know, just immerse myself in the history and the culture and the beginnings of Buddhism on home turf. It was just thrilling for the reasons that you mentioned. and, you know, the idea that, taking it larger, that life itself is a pilgrimage, and to live one's life like one would live on a pilgrimage, open to new ideas, being willing to let go of old conceptions and the whole process of what you do when you're on pilgrimage, to bring that into your life, that's a very exciting and very powerful thing for me. And the problem is, well, when I first came back, I was determined that was going to be, you know, my book that I was going to do instead of the Search in Secret India book. And I told this to a friend of mine, Rick Fields, who's no longer with us, but he was a brilliant Buddhist writer and a fantastic person. And I said, I'm going to do this book. And he said, well, you're going to undertake to do this book. That book's going to take you a lot longer than you think. And I often ask myself, why did he say that? Why did he say that? And as the years go by, it's less of a question. And other projects keep jumping up ahead. I think you know this as a writer who writes books. It's like, you know, you constantly have to struggle to maintain your focus on one project, even though new things are coming up and grabbing your attention and captivating your mind. But among the many projects that I'm determined to do, definitely Buddha Land and a look at life as pilgrimage, inspired by the Buddhist pilgrimage in India, is high on the list for sure.
What of all the places, what's the one that sticks in your mind the most?
Of the 8 great places?
Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, it's an interesting question because, you know, so many people know about some of the more well-known places that are classically associated with the Buddhist pilgrimage, like Bodh Gaya, where the Buddha became enlightened, and Lumbini, where he was born. But my heart was taken by a small little village, which was once very significant in the world of the Buddha many, many years ago, but now is a sleepy little village around a beautiful tank, or what you know they call a lake, a man-made lake, which was excavated and filled and created as a tank by the king of India at that time. And that's called Vaishali. And it's a little ways, a bit of a jaunt, maybe an hour or so from Patna. And this is basically bullseye in the most poor and underdeveloped part of India. India having a ways to go in general in that area, but this is like the farthest point from development. And it's very primitive. And that also gave it a very special quality. And I remember staying in a government lodging room, just spending time in this quiet place and sitting among the ruins, and there's a beautiful Ashokan pillar there, and some amazing, there's a small little ramshackle museum with beautiful objects that were found in the ground in the area, and I just felt so connected to that world there, and it was very mystical and powerful for me, and so I have never seen a more beautiful place in India than Vaishali. The trees of Vaishali being just a standout. They're the variety and the immensity and so that's if you're ever in Patna, you don't want to miss Vaishali.
Yeah. No, I remember that. I remember the tank very 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 well. And I'm trying to remember, why is that site important for the Buddha? What happened there?
Well, Vaishali was a retreat for the Buddha, who spent his time teaching in retreat and practicing in all these different areas of his world at the time, which was basically these eight cities in the area immediately surrounding them. But Vaishali was his vacation spot, as it were. But there's more significance to it than is coming to mind right now. I mean, Vaishali was a very important place,
Wasn't it that he we gotta wrap it up, but just one little bit. Was that
sure.
Where they went for the rainy season? Was that site?
Yes, I think he did spend some rainy seasons. There are other places more associated with rainy seasons, like Rajgir and Shravasti. But
right.
Vaishali was I think. The Buddha made some reference to the beauty of Vaishali as what was most significant for him. And historically, there were other events that happened there that were important. But I think it was the warmth in Buddha's heart for this place that I had a sense of or felt.
We're going to have to wrap it up right there. We'll stay with the
sure.
warmth in Buddha's heart. And thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind, Alan.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Great, great. All right. Well, see, next week I think we're going to talk to Stan Groff. So tune in, folks, and remember to keep your minds open.